Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Celebrating relations between Britain and the Holy See. A colloquium at the end of March looks at the past 30 years of full diplomatic relations, as well as digging deeper into the history of centuries past. Recalling the lasting legacy of Archbishop Oscar Romero of San Salvador more than three decades from his assassination. And headed for Mexico and Cuba, as Pope Benedict prepares to take off on his 23rd pastoral visit abroad, we hear of some hopes and expectations from inside the Vatican. In countries around the world this week, church leaders and Christians of all different denominations are marking the anniversary of the assassination of Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero. Known by people in El Salvador simply as Monseñor, Archbishop Romero was shot dead on March the 24th, 1980, while saying Mass in the small chapel of a hospital where he lived in the capital, San Salvador. Over three decades on from his death, Romero is revered by many as the voice of the voiceless. An inspirational figure for all who struggle to uphold the gospel values of human dignity, justice and peace. Philippa Hitchin brings us this tribute to the figure of Archbishop Oscar Romero.
As his death grew closer, he knew he was going to die. He saw his spiritual director on the very day he died and said he wanted to be clean before he met God.
Former director of the English Catholic aid agency CAFOD, Julian Filikowski, is also founder and chair of the Romero Trust, set up to promote greater awareness of the life and legacy of the assassinated Archbishop of San Salvador.
He today represents the essence of the option for the poor. He lived it, and he showed that the words were not some empty rhetoric of the last part of the 20th century, that they were something that could be lived. He was a martyr to the magisterium of the Church because his work alongside the poor in support of human rights and social justice was all done on the basis of the gospel and Catholic social teaching, of which he was an expert and which he taught with great vigour and great energy throughout the 3 years he was Archbishop. So the justice and peace movements and reconciliation movements around the world see Oscar Romero as a kind of icon, an icon of holiness, an example. And there's great yearning across the world to see him beatified and canonised, because really we want him as a patron saint of our movements.
You're talking about his option, his preferential option for the poor. Tell us about the situation there today, the challenges facing the church in El Salvador today.
Well, the poor of El Salvador are poor, but the poorest people, or many of the poorest people, have left the country. It's a different economy. It's a different place. There's a huge number of Salvadorans who've emigrated to the United States and also to Mexico and other places nearby. And their remittances from their work, their very poorly paid work usually, is the biggest element in the dollars earned by El Salvador today. So the poor are actually holding the country together financially in that way. And the land question is no longer so acute as it was in Archbishop Romero's time. And it's become a financial centre in some other ways. There has been progress, but the poor are poor and they need a pastor who cares about them. Interestingly, we've recently had a new archbishop in San Salvador, Archbishop Escobar Alas, a young bishop, and who is speaking in a very different language from his predecessor about the poor and about the place the poor have in the life of the church, and his commitment to Archbishop Romero and his beatification.
What was it that first drew you to this cause with such passion? It's become really your life's work at the moment, hasn't it?
Well, I was very committed to human rights work in Latin America. in that work, I was very close to the Society of Jesus, who taught me in my secondary school in Great Britain. And through them, I got to know Archbishop Romero. And it's the greatest grace and privilege of my life to have worked with him. And I feel that his example is just so powerful at this juncture. He really is, hopefully, a saint for the 21st century. I think people admire him. He's used in diaconate training programs as a model. Confirmation classes ask for the material about him because they see him as a soldier for Jesus Christ in the very best sense of that word. And I think for the world around us, to be a Christian leader today, what we're looking for are people who are credible witnesses to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And Oscar Romero is just utterly credible. He was a great, great witness to Jesus Christ. He was not a secularized bishop. He was not a populist bishop. He was a bishop with an immensely deep spirituality, a life of prayer. He made his decisions in contact with God. But he did it in absolute authentic fulfillment of the social teaching of the church. And as a man, he was loyal and author, as I said, an enthusiastic teacher of the church. But he also saw that the church was not just magister, it was matere magister. And so he was a wonderfully warm, encompassing, inclusive pastor. And he was really the beloved of the people there. And they cried, "We want bishops like Oscar Romero."
He was something of a reluctant leader, though, wasn't he? He didn't really fulfil this role until he was thrust into that position as archbishop there.
Oh, very much so. He's got a trajectory from his early priesthood where he was a great preacher. He had great oratorical skills. He was a great communicator. He was a journalist. He ran 3 dozen newspapers in different places he was. And he was very firm. And he was very committed to the poor. He gave all his belongings away when he was in San Miguel in the parishes. He used to have breakfast for the shoeshine boys. And he lived very, very simply. But that part was the kind of the hidden life. When he came to San Salvador, first of all, as an ecclesiastical bureaucrat, I think he was very disorientated and he lost his connection with the people at the grassroots. And he became really a very stuffy, haughty, pedantic ecclesiastical bureaucrat. And he was frightened by some of the things happening after the Council of Medellin and Vatican II. Not that he ever disowned them, but I think he had a midlife crisis. So people knew him at that time as someone who was a very defensive person and not someone who was embracing the Vatican II reforms. But we were wrong because the earlier Romero was the right one. So when he came to San Salvador, one has to recognise today, to the great dismay of the clergy and the people, it was a moment when he regained his balance and his equilibrium. He threw away those blue years of famine and became the pastor that he always was. And the killing within 2 weeks of his assuming office of Father Rutilio Grande, his friend, was a moment not of a Damascus moment when he was suddenly swiveled round at 180 degrees. It was a Gethsemane moment where, praying before his body, praying before his friend, he realised if he was to follow through what it would mean for him. And very soon afterwards, he wrote to one of the bishops in Latin America, "I think my new post has put me on the road to Calvary." And that was so prescient. And so he grew into the role. And the old, impatient, slightly nasty bureaucrat. And people, we mustn't airbrush or whitewash that out of the history that was that period, was gone. And he actually, during his 3 years, went around to many of the communities when he was there. His first thing he did was to apologise for his behaviour when he'd been with them before, that he had not lived up to the teaching of the church in the way that he treated them, and he wanted to make up to them. And that readiness to say mea culpa, to be self-critical of himself and of his church in a loyal and immensely committed way, was what made him what he was. And his motto, which was right across his mitre, was sentire come ecclesia, to feel for, to palpitate with the church, taken from St. Ignatius' Exercises.
thanks there to the former director of the English Catholic Aid Agency, CAFOD, Julian Filakowski, who's also the founder and chair of the Romero Trust, set up to promote greater awareness of the life and legacy of the assassinated Archbishop of San Salvador.
And now Philippa looks ahead to an event to be held next week here at the British Embassy to the Holy See. During what will be called a colloquium, Catholic and Anglican church leaders from across Britain, as well as diplomats and historians, will study and discuss diplomatic relations between the United Kingdom and the Vatican.
On Friday, March 30th, the British Embassy to the Holy See will hold a colloquium celebrating 3 decades of full diplomatic relations between the two states. The event marks the 30th anniversary of the upgrading of relations just ahead of Pope John Paul II's historic pastoral visit to England, Scotland and Wales in May 1982. The colloquium, hosted by the Venerable English College here in Rome, will include Catholic and Anglican church leaders, as well as diplomats and historians exploring the past, present and future of both ecumenical and diplomatic relations. While the events of 1982 marked a hugely significant milestone on the road to post-Reformation reconciliation, the history of relations between Britain and the Holy See stretches much further back. In fact, the current British ambassador describes it as the oldest relationship that his government maintains with any state in the world. Ahead of the colloquium, Ambassador Nigel Baker came into our studios to tell me more about this colourful history of relations between the two states. Welcome to Vatican Radio once again.
Thank you very much.
It's a relationship that goes back a long way, a lot further than most people realise, I think, back to the late 15th century. Tell us how it all began.
Yes, I mean, of course one could say it goes back even further. As long as there has been, in that case, a King of England and a Pope, there have been relations between courts of different ways. But the first person who is commonly regarded as the ambassador, the English ambassador to the Holy See, was John Sherwin, who was appointed by King Edward IV in 1479. So in terms of a permanent relationship, he is in fact our first ever permanent ambassadorial appointment overseas. So I always claim that I represent the oldest British embassy in existence. And that sort of relationship, although of course there was a long gap during the period of the Reformation.
That of course was just shortly before the break with Rome, wasn't it?
Yeah, and an ambassador did return during the reign of Queen Mary. His tomb is, in fact, up at St. Gregory the Great Monastery here in Rome. But there was that long break from Queen Elizabeth through until the re-establishment of a diplomatic relationship in 1914.
Just at the beginning or at the outset of the First World War. What was the significance of that, do you think?
I think it demonstrated why the British government felt the need to have a relationship with the Holy See once again. There had been all sorts of unofficial, both representatives and attempts to strengthen relationship during the 19th century. But when war broke out in 1914, the Allied countries, Britain, France and Russia, realised that they did not have a representative here at the Holy See. At a time when Benedict XV was, of course, very active in his efforts to initially prevent the outbreak of war, and once it had broken out, to find ways to bring the warring parties to a table. Now, for various reasons, France and Russia weren't able to move rapidly, but the United Kingdom decided that this was the time to have diplomatic relations once again. So appointed at the time a minister, so one step below ambassador level, who presented credentials right at the end of 1914, and an apostolic legate was also duly appointed to in the United Kingdom. So we'll soon be celebrating about 100 years of diplomatic relationship, but it remained at minister level from 1914.
Until 1982, that was when full diplomatic relations were restored at the beginning of April, just shortly before the first ever papal visit to London.
Exactly. My predecessor, Sir Mark Heath, who was here as minister, presented his credentials on the 1st of April, 1982, which is why this event is taking place on the 30th of March, as close as we can to that date. And I think both sides recognise, both the Holy See and the British government recognise, that with the visit of Pope John Paul II, as you say, the first ever visit of a reigning pontiff to the United Kingdom, that our relationship had matured sufficiently to put it on a full ambassadorial level. And therefore, although the visit was a pastoral visit, it was not a state visit like the visit we've just had from Pope Benedict XVI in 2010. It was clearly a significant moment in the relationship between the United Kingdom and the Holy See, and appropriate that we had a full ambassador and a full apostolic nuncio to take the relationship forward following the visit.
It's quite significant, isn't it, that until just very recently, until your immediate predecessor, the ambassador had to be an Anglican. And this, in a way, underlines both the political but also the religious dimension of this relationship.
The fascinating thing about this relationship, it is multidimensional. It is not like any other diplomatic relationship that we have. It operates on a local level. There is a Catholic community in the United Kingdom that, of course, is directly engaged in this relationship. A traditional bilateral relationship, you might say, United Kingdom related to the world of the Vatican City State. But I'm accredited to the Holy See, and therefore it enters into a completely different level, the global Catholic Church. So it operates on many, many different dimensions, and clearly an ambassador to the Holy See has to, as he would in any other country, but be able to understand and appreciate the particularities of the government, the organisation to which he's accredited. If you don't understand religion or are not interested in religion, I suspect the Holy See is probably not the best post for you.
You mentioned the 2010 state visit of Pope Benedict to the UK. That really gave a very significant boost to this relationship, didn't it?
It really did. And somebody said to me, oh, why are you celebrating 1982 when, of course, you've now moved even further now with the 2010 visit? And my thesis really is that 1982 was a crucial step along that path. It was a pastoral visit. Pope John Paul II was in Wales, and Scotland was in England. And I think one can say quite fairly that 2010 would not have been possible without 1982, but you're absolutely right. 2010 was another further enormous step forward. The fact that it was a state visit, the fact that it went way beyond the pastoral dimension, it demonstrated the incredible richness of the relationship between the United Kingdom and the Holy See in all sorts of different areas. And, of course, also the extraordinary speeches of Pope Benedict, particularly the speech in Westminster Hall, which addressed directly the complicated and complex nature of the historical relationship between Britain and the Holy See.
And the role of faith in public life today. It's still a very difficult question, isn't it? A controversial question for many.
Yes, I think it is. I mean, there's been a lot of debate about that in the United Kingdom recently. We had the visit of our British government delegation here and Baroness Wasey talking very forcefully about the importance of faith in British society. The day after that visit, Her Majesty the Queen visited Lambeth Palace, was received by the Archbishop of Canterbury and other religious leaders. And she too addressed precisely this question of the importance of faith as a defining force, really, in the sort of complicated tapestry which has helped to make up the British character in different ways, in different parts of the United Kingdom, and not just talking about the Christian faith or the established church, but talking about the relationship between Anglicanism, its role in generating understanding of faith, and its relationship in relation to the state with the Catholic Church, other Christian churches, with Islam, with Hinduism, with Judaism, with atheism. Faith has always been part of British makeup and always been really there at the centre of British society, going back to 1982, 1914, 1479, or even further.
The obvious question, I suppose, then, is the challenges for the future. What are you hoping to do, in a sense, during your time here, but to build on these significant steps that have taken place just recently?
Well, we have an extraordinary agenda of work to take forward with the Holy See. I think quite a lot of that was encapsulated in a joint communique that the Holy See and the British government signed during the visit. A range of areas where we've got a lot to do together, working together against discrimination on faith grounds, for example, in different parts of the world, in sort of human rights work, looking at how we can work together in the aid and development area, Africa, we talked about particularly, and delighted with the support of the Holy See for the conference on Somalia that the Prime Minister hosted in London just a week or so after that visit. Areas in culture, the important role of the Catholic Church can play in the role of reconciliation in Northern Ireland. Every time I sort of look at my to-do list, it seems to get longer and longer because the relationship is very broad and I think quite untapped in a lot of different areas. We have these two extraordinary networks, the British network, our own diplomatic missions, plugging into the Commonwealth network, this network that the Holy See, its own diplomatic missions, but also the broader Catholic Church. There's a lot we can do together, working, you know, for the common good, and I think we can explore these more fully, both on the British side and the Holy See side. I think perhaps one could say, going back, not in perhaps in immediate history, but some years before, you know, perhaps we neglected the possibilities, and now's the time to really redo something together.
This colloquium is going to reinforce that. It's very much looking back at the history, isn't it? You've got some top historians, Anglican and Catholic experts, but I also, I imagine, looking ahead again to the challenges, to the areas, these unexplored areas, as you call them.
No, as a historian, I'm a great believer that you can't understand your present and you can't really try and even make an effort at working out your future unless you know something about your past. So it is looking back at 1982, but it's very much looking back with a contemporary eye. We have churchmen who will be coming who were very much involved in the 1982 visit, like Cardinal Cormack, like Cardinal Kirkpatrick O'Brien, and others who, but you know, that now they are in important positions and they very much are a part of the present of the Catholic Church in Britain. We'll be looking at the ecumenical relationship between Anglicanism and Catholicism. Looking back to 82, the Vatican too, the Vatican Council, but also very much where it is now and what we're going to be doing looking ahead. And these are all, that's also very much the facet, the key aspect of the historical relationship we want to bring out. The diplomatic relationship, you know, there's a story. It goes back to 1914 and before. It looks to 1982, to the present. But you know, part of that story is, you know, our unknown relationship looking ahead. And I'm delighted that we've got, you know, as a final session, we're going to be looking at the 19th century, and particularly we've got Eamon Duffy, who's going to be talking about Cardinal Newman, the blessed Cardinal Newman. Part of the 2010 visit was one of the most important aspects of that was the beatification of Cardinal Newman. And perhaps Eamon Duffy will be looking forward to possible future canonisation of the blessed Cardinal Newman in his talk during the colloquium. So it really is, it's about past, it's about now, but it's going to be looking ahead as well.
My thanks there to the British Ambassador to the Holy See, Nigel Baker, whose embassy will be hosting a colloquium on Friday, March the 30th at the Venerable English College here in Rome.
And as Pope Benedict XVI prepares to head off to Mexico and Cuba on his 23rd visit abroad, a visit that is scheduled to last from the 23rd to the 29th of March, I had the chance to speak to Cardinal Peter Turkson, President of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. I asked him about his hopes and expectations regarding the Pope's visit. Cardinal Turkson said the two countries share a Latin tradition, but historically, politically, and economically, they have developed in very different directions.
In both places, I suppose there are issues of interest to this dicastery. You know, Mexico has got its own political history too, and the political history which affects the relationship with the church. And, you know, happily, I suppose things are, you know, changed for the better now. But for us and for the business we do over here, of course, the issue of human rights still comes up. No, it's not as hot as it was, you know, some years back. And we thank God for that. But we presently, though, the big thing is about, unfortunately, the thing about, you know, increasing a dominance, if you want, of, you know, drug-related crimes, okay, in Mexico. That's the thing that bothers us right now. A lot of, you know, drug-related crimes in Mexico is a thing of concern to us. Seeing, you know, this is a country that borders in the United States, Its effect on the U.S. needs to be thought about, or the U.S. effect also on that needs to be thought about. The relatedness of this to the migration that's still ongoing between the two countries and all of so, and ultimately the security and stability in Mexico itself. So these are issues that I think we think about. Certainly the Holy Father would have his own, you know, way of addressing those issues, and probably others that, you know, he sees from his universal leadership of the church. But Mexico is very Christian. You know, my own experience, I was in the Eucharistic Congress in Guadalajara some years back, and I have since been in two Eucharistic Congress international, or that, and the next one I was at was Quebec. Quebec doesn't compare with what we had in Guadalajara. In Guadalajara was a thing of the whole population, millions of people, if you want. And as we did a procession, everybody hangs some devotional thing out of the window, some piece of, you know, some religiously decorated item. Everybody was with it. So that's what I mean. Somebody may say it's very superficial, but whatever it is, you had that, you know, expression of, you know, every, you know, warmth of, you know, participation and all of that. The Christian tradition is there. And probably like very many other Latin American countries, the challenge is making something which is seen as tradition become a regular form of life. You know, so making this come to the surface, become the pattern. So may not suffice to just consider yourself by, you know, history, a tradition, or something of the past, but what does it mean to be a Christian, a witness to a Christian faith, live it, you know, concretely now. That may be one of the challenges, but especially in the area of crime and, you know, the drug, you know, war type of thing going on. It's our prayer that the visit of the Holy Father touches hearts and, you know, induce some kind of conversion in that area and that front. If you come to the other side, the stories will be different. Cuba, of course, over here, since the Pope announced the visit, we get some mails and some correspondent people who protest. But I mean, the Lord said it. I didn't come for the righteous, I came for the sinners. So the Holy Father doesn't have to visit only the saintly and the good places, but also even where there are perceived problems and, you know, all of it. So I personally have nothing against a visit to Cuba. And I, you know, indeed, for me, it's a joy. And plus, you know, the form of government does not mean that even every citizen, okay, also moves that. So the protests mostly come from Cubans in exile or the diaspora living in the United States who are protesting this and thinking that the church should rather call for some more, you know, liberty, respect of human rights and all of that and that. But again, we leave it to the Holy Father. But I think it's also gone a long way. It's not the same Cuba of the Cold War. It's not the same Cuba of the missile crisis of Cuba. A lot of things have changed. And in Cuba of the present-day experience, it's also a Cuba, you know, how many volunteers he sends out to help in, you know, hospitals of poorer countries and all. So it's still a Cuba who would, whatever type of, still find a way to still share with the outside world some of its meager resources. It's a country where political ideology may probably lead to a certain form of, you know, government, but the faith is still there. I suppose in that sense, the visit for me, it's a very good one, and we're hoping that, again, whatever message the Holy Father will have to deliver will still be well, you know, listened and taken, and, you know, whatever, again, conversions can be induced, you know, we pray the Lord, you know, to have his own way.
You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program, Laudetur Jesus Christus.